Welcome and thank you for tuning in to the Visit the Northeast of Scotland podcast with me, your host, Jacqueline Vandenacker. In this episode, we're speaking with Blue Badge tour guide Alistair Brody. Alistair is born and raised in Aberdeenshire and grew up on a farm where he developed his passion for agriculture. Alistair talks about the agricultural history of Aberdeenshire and how it became an efficient and productive area for Scotland, supplying high-quality ingredients and food and drink products. He also shares with us his view on how food production has changed over the years, as well as some of his favourite foods from the area. Alistair has a passion for whisky and Highland games, which are both iconic for Scotland, and is dedicated to sharing with visitors the special place that he calls home. Good afternoon, Alistair, and thank you for joining me here today at Thainston House Hotel. We're looking forward to finding out more about you today and discovering more about the heritage of the northeast of Scotland. So to start us off, could you please give us an introduction of yourself and how you became a tourist guide?
Thank you very much, Jacqueline. We're in a lovely venue here at Thainston House, and situated in rural Aberdeenshire, where I've been all my days. Born and brought up on a traditional Aberdeenshire farm, a small family unit, and experienced visitors from abroad and locally, I suppose, as well, for the fact that we had a caravan site on our farm. Tourism came to be second nature. And through my life and work, I've been involved with having groups from abroad, and discovered that I had a passion for guiding, and that the Blue Badge guide suited me perfectly. And it was some 6 years ago that I took the plunge and became trained for it. And the northeast of Scotland is my homeland, there's no doubt about that. So I love letting people share where we've got, where we live.
Can you tell us the process of becoming a Blue Badge guide?
Yes, you have to go through an interview process, which when you're in your mid to late 50s is quite daunting. And if it's for you, it'll be the right thing. And so you go through quite a exacting process. It's not don't open the door to everyone. And having been accepted, you then embark on a two-year course where you have usually to travel to the central belt of Scotland. And then you have got rigorous training of, it's usually done through weekends and tour of, schools, be it a week long time to go around Scotland. We have, I always describe it as being layered, in that there is, you start from geology, architecture, all the way through the different periods of that. It's simply not just history, obviously. It's all the different facets of it. And it's split into two sides. There is the facts and figures, and there is how to guide. And that is just equally as important as knowing all the facts. So thankfully I went through it and qualified and haven't looked back. I just love it. Guiding is fun, is the strapline.
I would agree, guiding is fun. So you mentioned you were born on a farm, and the northeast of Scotland is very agricultural. Can you describe what are some of the agricultural mainstays? Because you've been working in agriculture prior to becoming a guide.
Yes, indeed. The northeast of Scotland is, to some degrees, the forgotten shoulder of our country. Being on the east side, the farming mainstays of Aberdeenshire, I would say, are definitely livestock. Livestock has been either born here or brought in here to finish traditionally. We have got such a terrific landscape in that we have got the potential to grow lots of good cereals. And there was the Agricultural Improvements Act, which came through in the late 1700s, transformed Aberdeenshire from being a wet, boggy land into being so fertile and productive, and livestock was what made it such. Every farm would have had cattle, sheep, pigs, and hens, poultry at some stage. And there's a number of books that's been written on how it has benefited the whole northeast of Scotland.
Am I right in thinking that part of the farming improvement program was putting in lots of drainage into the fields so that they have gullies running underneath the farming fields to help drain the land so that it would be suitable for arable farming.
Yes, Jacqueline, you're correct with that. That was one of the keys, but there was a number of other ones, but I'll keep on the drainage one first. The land was obviously traditionally boggy, and it was a case of getting drains set in such a way that they would run properly towards your gullies or ditches, as we speak about, and then eventually into the burn, which is a stream. We would call it a burn in Aberdeenshire. Nothing to do with fire. And these drains were what we classify as stone drains, and they were built with flat stones. And the skill to dig those were absolutely immense, and it was dreadful work because it was always wet and you were, you know, trench digging and things like this. But that was one of the key ones. The other thing to improve the land was enclosures. Now, that was something different because the land was more or less a general... and you get it sometimes, you still get it in the Western Isles, where it's common land. But when landowners were all of a sudden bequeathed an estate or an area of land, they wanted to draw it down into packages, which we call farm toons, not big farms. And then they'd have smaller ones as well. They could then let it out to a tenant. But by having enclosures, you meant you could have your stock safe. And so they were usually made of stones from land gatherings, things like this. And you had dikes as well, as we speak about. And you had actual teams of men going around the countryside physically making these stone enclosures. And the other key one, before I would depart, is that the addition of lime. Because by putting lime onto the land, raised the pH, and then you're allowed to maybe grow better crops and things like that. But yes, a revolution happened, there's no doubt about that.
With the enclosures and the stone walls and dikes, was that also when the tradition of crofting started, or was that before?
Crofting would still have existed before, but it would have been in a less organised way, probably. You would have had a house, which would have been a large house, but the cattle would have been within the house with you, and the land would have been land which was, as I say, grazed, right? You were allowed to graze it. So you would have had your, say, two cows in that house, and maybe their calves and their young stock as well. And that was a crofting situation, that's right. But crofts became more organised, I'll say, because they were usually on the fringes of the good agricultural land. They were never on the best land, fortunately. And you still see the crofting situation, especially in the Isles and the West Coast, where there's, you know, a lot of more rock and thin soil types. And then 7, 8, 10 acres, whatever, you know, it was quite a lot for, remember, and often part-time. You know, that man would have been working full-time on a farm and then coming home at night.
Doing it all again. Yeah. How do you think farming's changed over the last 50, 60 years?
Wow. I love looking into the background of farming, and I don't hope you mind me just referring to one of my favourite books called The Conquistor Days by David Kerr Cameron. And he explains the process where farming evolved in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the advance of mechanisation and how reduction in staff was needed, because it was just that it was a way of life, and many farms employed 10, 12 staff. Today, since the Second World War especially, the advent of machinery has had leaps and bounds, and that way of life has departed to a fair degree. We are now really in the computer age, and any tractor as such will be programmed. You have your fields all satellite scanned so that they know it. The sprayer will apply the precise amount of spray and fertilizer into every corner and things like that, because it's a business, remember, they're running. And so farming has evolved beyond all measure, and I'm sure will happen again.
Sometimes when you speak to visitors and guests who come to the northeast of Scotland, or even if you mention that you're a tour guide here in Scotland, some people will think with Angus beef, when you mention Aberdeen, for Aberdeen Angus. And whisky, obviously, is very much a known commodity here in Scotland. But the Northeast is known for a lot of different kinds of produce. What food or drink products do you think describe the Northeast best?
That's a cracker of a question, just right up my street. If you look upon Scotland as a country, and imagine the east coast of our country as being the top of it, which is not, but the east coast side, I would describe our food and drink industry as a crown. And on that crown, there are two jewels. And yes, they're namely whisky, which comes from malting barley, which is grown on the east coast, and Aberdeen Angus cattle, or known nowadays as Angus, certainly in the North Americas. But we have got so many more precious jewels below those. I would start by saying we have got lamb, which Scottish people, by historical, don't eat so much lamb. And I have had many visitors asking me, why have I not seen lamb on the menu? And my answer is because the Scottish people don't tend to eat so much. We breed it here, and especially in the northeast of Scotland, this is traditionally where it's all finished or fattened. Now, it's taken onto our land here, grass-fed, maybe cereals to finish them off properly, and we export so much lamb, and it is so tasty. The other one is pork, often avoided, never even thought about. And the same again, it's not often on a menu, but can be very succulent and tasty. And we have got outdoor bread and indoor, and that's also basically on the east coast. Then moving on, we've got something relatively new in the last 20 to 30 years in our food and drink offering, and that is fruit. We've always had it in Blairgowrie and Kerrymuir and places like that, and soft fruit was grown traditionally outside, and it was a six-week period. It was ideal for harvesting it in strawberries. Whereas now, our fruit season will spread from, I believe, end of February to November. And that's thanks to our polytunnels and whatever. Mm-hmm. And note should be made of the plant breeding station we have at Invergowrie, where they have managed to breed new varieties of berries, making them larger, more succulent, spreading the harvest season for ripening and things like this. So we have such a wonderful offering of soft fruits in Scotland. And I can't finish off without saying about our craft brewing industry we have, because 20 years ago we would never have heard of it other than the multinationals that we had, and now it's something that people will ask by name when they go into places, what have you got on tap today? And our local breweries are doing a fantastic job.
There certainly has been a big increase in the number of craft breweries over the last, like you say, 20 years. And I think that goes hand in hand with the whole evolving of our cuisine. Our traditional cuisine as well has been updated and given a fresh look, I guess. And long gone are those days where visitors would think of British food as being bland and not that exciting. It's certainly not culinary by any standards, but that, I think that has changed. How do you feel about that?
Yes, I can't agree more in that I do think that in the Northeast, we tend to be quite reluctant to boast about some of our best things that we have. And now we are getting a real pride in it. And I think this happened during probably the 1990s, when farmers had to start thinking about their markets and started doing farmers' markets. And they became, you know, a way of going direct to the public, and then they had to explain how best to cook it and things like this. Now we've got a generation of chefs who have got their restaurants and hotels who are desperately looking for local product, and the customers are doing similar. They're looking on the menu and checking where it's from. We have got, I mean, our local ice cream in the northeast of Scotland, Mackies of Scotland, mm-hmm. and they're exported all over now. Yogurt making facilities as well from the northeast. It's just that it's taken a while for Scots to be able to say something's good rather than it's nae bad.
We mentioned in the introduction that you are a tour guide and you tour throughout the whole of Scotland and not just here in the northeast. And can you give us some idea about when you bring people from Edinburgh or Glasgow, or if you're coming into the northeast of Scotland, what are some of the differences or comments that people remark upon when they visit here?
Yes, there's certainly a variety of landscapes that we have. When you're mentioning Edinburgh, you leave Edinburgh and you're leaving a large city. You know, we've got some wonderful structures, and the Forth Road Bridge and the railway bridges are takes your breath back. But the variety of landscapes, I would say, is what we have. Because when you are in the lowlands, you've got large fields and you've got landscapes on the seaside. But as a further north you come, especially if you come up the A9 between Perth and Inverness, it changes dramatically into the Highland appearance. And you've got certainly high peaks there. And people like the variety. That's what they really do. It's not like you're in a continent where you have to travel 200 miles or 4 hours before it changes. It's changing probably in within an hour. You know, you'll be seeing one landscape and you see another. So it's never boring.
We spoke before the interview about some of the tours that you had scheduled this year. And we've just mentioned Braemar. And Braemar is very infamous and famous for its Highland Games, which I know is something you're very passionate about. Could you tell us how the Highland Games have developed?
Yes, thank you. That's one that's often asked. Highland Games are held virtually all over Scotland in many towns and villages. Originally, I believe they were started, and reading this, the fact is that it's from Malcolm Canmore in 1040. And it was a way of selecting his fighting men and, you know, to compete against each other. And it didn't end there, because it was a case of clans trying to compete against their neighbouring ones to see how strong they were. And what they did was they went to their neighbouring one, and yes, there were skirmishes and there were battles and things like this, but in time of peace, they then evolved into having it, as I say, throwing the hammer, tossing the cabre and things like this to get more dignified. The strength of having good people against other ones that is borne out. And I was just thinking, that used to happen up until when I was quite young. And I remember clearly how a village would pit themselves against the next door village. So it was regional. But whereas the Highland Games are now absolutely one of our one of the proudest things we have, because you get men competing and girls as well competing in all their different games. And it's absolutely a fun day out for everyone.
It is, and athletes will go from town to town through the whole of the summer season and compete in different events throughout the season, is that right?
Very much so. It's I know some of them quite well. That's like semi-professional to some degree. They will make themselves ready for the season and go around the circuit, as they speak about. And of course, we are delighted to have so many international guests come to join us. But there's international athletes come as well to participate. So it's certainly taken very seriously. And remember, it's a great chance to meet up with your old friends. At the end of the day, you might even have time for a dram.
So in your work as a tour guide, and you work with Select Scotland Tours, with the assistance of several other guides, you offer services throughout the whole of Scotland. Can you give us some examples of some of the tours that you do that are very popular, or are all of your tours bespoke and custom?
Yes, I've had a variety of different people and experiences. Some of my best ones have been the ones that when you ask the guest, what do you want to do today? And they're saying, well, we've this down on the itinerary, but we'd like to do something different. And if it allows, it's great that you're able to do that. So you're taking them to exactly what they're looking for. Some of the ones I really enjoy is taking them around the coastline and letting them see hidden bays where you can just get yourself, you have to walk down to them, and they're sheltered. And there's that cave around there, you know, it's only accessible when it's low tide. And, you know, that's a little extra you'd like to share with people, because a lot of this coastline was, obviously, smugglers would come in at time to time, was different. So, and then the other thing I like doing with people, taking them onto an actual farm, a working farm, to let them see how a farmer will be giving great attention to their stock and dressing them up maybe for a show and preparing them, and the effort it goes in to do that. And then following the process through as well, maybe a grain farmer where he makes a point of having the best malt barley possible. And then taking it on to the next stage, to the maltings and ultimately the distillery.
So besides farming and besides tour guiding, I believe one of your other passions is whiskey.
Have you been doing research?
Of course, yes.
Yes, well, a local friend of mine said to me, he said, "There's not a whiskey I don't like." He says, "You're supposed to persevere longer, but you like them eventually." And I must admit that some people don't care for the West Coast whiskies as much as they do for a Speyside one. And I was never one that found that at all, but it takes you sometimes to go there. And I went to Islay and I visited some distilleries, and I can now hold my hand up and say there's some of them is absolutely top of the tree. And I would tell that to people from, I'm afraid, Buchan, which wouldn't go down too well. On whiskey, what I like to do, and I've done something this summer when there's been quiet time, is to follow the process of sowing right through to the harvesting of the malt barley. Simply, it's a case of getting the land prepared right, getting the sowing date right, and then all the processes that goes through are that afterwards. And then what you're ultimately waiting for is to get the right harvest time, and then that grain has to pass through so many different criteria for being accepted as malting barley. So there's this behind-the-scenes thing that you have to get your malt accepted and then taken over to the maltsters and then onto the distillery. Because every distillery you visit will tell you the different twist of how different they are and whatever they're doing. And there are certainly not two the same. There isn't. Mm-hmm. And we're lucky to still have as many. In fact, there's a growing number of distilleries now. So we're on the ascendancy, I would say, at the moment with our distilling.
One of the things we love in this area, and particularly Scotland, I think, is known for its folklore and its stories. And we all like to tell a good story. But I'm assuming there's going to be stories for agriculture.
Very much, Jacqueline. Farming is steeped in folklore and traditions and different sort of traditions that they think are worthy of keeping up. I'm afraid with the advent of machinery, that's beginning to fall by the wayside. But if you cast your mind back 100 years, it's a harvest time that there was a lot of traditions. And one of them is when they would have been cutting the cereal, and when it came to the last field and the last sheaf, that sheaf, which is a bunch of barley bound together, it would be kept aside. And there was always traditions along with that sheaf, what to do with it. It would be often kept till New Year, but that sheaf would sometimes be fed to a horse or to the milking cow, things like that, and kept. And another thing I will touch on is that at the end of harvest time, as a celebration, there would be what we call the meal and ale. This was a very, you know, it was a celebration of having got the harvest all gathered in, and a relief, really. And it was made in a large bucket. So the recipe for that was a bottle of stout, half a bottle of whiskey, two bottles of brisk ale, then poured into this large pail with a bowlful of sugar stirred in. Oatmeal was in as well to give it a bit of consistency, and then it was into a sort of like a thin porridge. Sugar was actually put on top again, and this was the toast, which was handed round. So this was something, so it's there's many traditions.
That sounds like a very potent mixture. You've lived here in the Northeast all your life. How do you describe the place that you live when you're out and about meeting new people?
I would describe it as being an undulating countryside. And there was a farmer from Fife came up and he just said, Aberdeenshire tends to roll on and on and on. But it's 90% agricultural land. It is, it's true. It just has got rolling hillsides and with a very interesting coastline.
Is there anything you would like to add to the podcast that I haven't asked you about? Anything that you think would be really interesting for our listeners?
I would simply say that when you see Scotland advertised in some travel magazine, you get given the idea that Scotland is full of simply whiskey and wonderful, spectacular scenery, especially in the West Coast. What we have got is a huge lot more of an offering than that. And I would love to be able to share that with you and take you to the hidden spots that we have.
Well, Alistair, thank you very much for spending the afternoon with me and sharing your knowledge and information about Aberdeenshire and the whole of the northeast of Scotland. And I look forward to a time when we can meet again. And thank you again for spending the afternoon.
Well, thank you very much. And I'd love to be able to share more time as well and share the Doric that we've got as
well. Oh, yes. Very good.